The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower & Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center, with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I am Mark Amtower. I'm here today with two industry veterans, Simone Seichman, currently at Attain as CTO, and Stan Soloway, formerly of PSC, now at Solero Strategies. Gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Stan, start off for the few people out there who may not know who you are. Tell them who you are, what you do, what you did at PSC, and what Solero is all about.
I'll let other people describe what I did at PSC or did to PSC, but I've been around the industry for about 25 or 30 years after I did the last 4 years of the first Clinton administration at the Defense Department and came over to the Professional Services Council, which is, as you know, the largest trade association of services and technology companies. And then after 15 years, decided to step down and pursue a whole new career line. So I've started Solero Strategies earlier this year. And we're working with a whole range of companies, small, medium, and large, on market positioning, market trends, market strategies, kind of the full kind of life cycle growth approach and having a ball.
Okay, having a ball. So this is not a transitional position. This is what you want to do now.
Transitional to what? I mean,
well, you know, usually somebody comes out of PSC or something like PSC.
Retire.
You go to one. No, you go to one of the biggies as a partner or something. You know, a Deloitte.
No. That's not. I'm not. This is what I left to do, and it's. I'm having fun with it.
There you go. Simone, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. So tell people where you spent your gov time, and then why Attain.
I had a career of almost 20 years in the federal government. The last 7.5 years were spent as CIO at NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and then after that at the Department of Commerce. And after those almost 20 years in the government, I decided it was time to do new things and learn new things. So I moved over to the private sector, where I am now at Attain as the Chief Technology Officer.
And you look like you're like 25. You pissed me off. all right. So we're going to cover a lot of ground here today. Stan, I know this is one near and dear to you. And Simone, if you have some thoughts, jump in. But I know you've written recently about the fair pay gig. So what is it, and why is it possibly not what it purports to be?
Well, so the background is the president issued an executive order, I guess it's 18 months ago now or so, called the Fair Pay and Safe Workplace Executive Order. And the intent of the executive order was to ensure that companies that get federal contracts are adhering to federal labor laws, both on the wage and benefit side, as well as on the safety and health side. It is a sort of the stepchild of an order that came out at the end of the Clinton administration, actually late 1999 or late 2000. That we called affectionately the blacklisting rule. And I say that as somebody who was in the administration at the time when we did it, had a very similar intent. And so you can't really argue with the intent. The problem is you can really argue with the way the executive order is structured and with now what you're referring to is the final rules that have come out about implementing it. In really simple terms, the Fair Pay and Safe Workplace executive order requires that a company certify every time it submits a proposal that it has no violations of any of about 14 different federal labor laws, and then a still undetermined number of state and local laws. They're still working through some of those details, which, as I said, sounds fine on the surface. But basically, what it comes down to is that, number one, you can still be effectively suspended. You can be denied access to a contract opportunity merely on the basis of an unadjudicated allegation. There is really no set of metrics in it to decide what is a lawbreaker. And that sounds a little bit flippant, but if you have two violations of the Service Contract Act, which might be one of the most complicated pieces of legislation to try to get right, and companies make mistakes, administrative errors all the time, government makes administrative errors with it all the time, no matter if the government makes the error, it's still the company's violation. What is a pattern of abuse of law? where does I paid this fine because I did that. Now we're moving on. We changed out our leadership. We did that. All of those kinds of things that you, when an institution faces any kind of a problem, minor to major, the real question is how does it respond and how does it get to root cause? This rule completely ignores all that and becomes it's way overly simplistic view of the marketplace. The problem finally
sort of,
with the
sort of the Bob O'Hara approach.
Well, I'm not. You said that I didn't. I'm actually. I like Bob. We've had our differences, but I like him. But I think the key thing here is that the rulemakers actually, if you read the final rule, which I think four people will, because it's never fun to actually read a rule. But they actually tried to, I think, improve on the executive order because they know that this thing was way over the top in terms of how it came at it. But the way the system works is, once the executive order is out, the rulemakers have to stick to the letter of the executive order. So they can manipulate as much as they want, but as long as they stay within the bounds. So if the executive order says you can be denied a contract on the basis of an EEOC complaint that may or may not have been fully adjudicated, you can't change that in the rule. You have to stick to that when you do the rules. And so they were very much hamstrung by a really, as I said, over the top, I think, potentially really unfair order with a very good intent, but one for the first time that basically says, yeah, due process isn't really what we're all about here. It's going to be some vague set of as yet determined perceptions and decisions made by an as yet unhired and untrained new workforce of what they call labor compliance advisors working with contracting officers. I think trying to ask folks like that to interpret things this complicated is really
tough.
Is
this from Orwell or Huxley? Any thoughts at all on that? Or,
well, I think it definitely adds a lot of complexity, particularly for the smaller companies that don't have the machinery internally to deal with these kinds of matters. As Stan said, mistakes sometimes happen, and when you don't have a heavy legal machine and administrative structure, it's difficult. So I think this certainly touches all of the businesses doing work in this space, but particularly the smaller companies that may be a little less prepared to know how to respond.
So Mark, let me just give a contextual example here. So if you sometimes the best way to look at something like this is what are the advocates of it saying, and as the underpinning position of those who say we need to do this accurate. So if you look at some of the work that's come out, there was a paper written the day after the rules came out. It was an article I saw saying we need this because and they started listing all of the government contractors that had to pay these, quote, massive fines for massive labor and safety violations. If you break down the list that they put, the top 20, the top two, well, the top one, but with like 65% of all the fines is BP from the Horizon disaster, which wasn't even a government contract. Now, we all agree it was a disaster.
Right.
But when I take one massive set of fines and say, see, we've got $100 billion in fines, but $65 billion, whatever the number is, was paid by one company, that kind of changes the context. The second thing is they talk about the need to do this and how states have been doing this and have great success. Well, most of the states, if not all of them, that have gone down this path do not have what we have at the federal level, which are called prevailing wage laws. So we have a Davis-Bacon Act and a Service Contract Act that tell you if you're in construction or services, absolutely what you have to pay your employees, what the health and welfare benefits have to be. The states don't have that, so they needed a policing mechanism to do what the Service Contract Act, for instance, is designed to do, which is keep wages from becoming the bargaining chip, particularly for those who are most vulnerable in the workforce, which is hourly wage labor at the sort of mid to lower end of the marketplace. So you take those two things and you realize, well, okay, so that's not an issue. Then the third is, well, we don't have any mechanism to stop crooks from getting contracts. Well, if you look at all the data, there has been a massive increase in suspension and debarments across the government for the last decade. And so, in fact, we are seeing greater use of the authorities the government has. The government has every authority it needs today to say Soloway Incorporated cannot have this contract because we don't think they're a responsible company because they get 37 violations of the Service Contract Act. They can do that if they want. So all of the things that it's designed to do either are unnecessary or already exist. So it's not an issue of pro-crook, anti-crook. It's an issue of how do you logically implement this and not create such a massive regime of compliance that for small companies becomes an enormous burden, but also places good, well-behaved companies at risk because of somebody else's perceptions.
The other issue that comes up, I think, is the recourse for the companies that are suspended or debarred. There seems to be less recourse with this method than with the in-place methods right now. Is that accurate?
Well, it's to be determined because we haven't hit execution yet or implementation yet. The analogy I sometimes draw is the debate we had over the last few years over what they call tax cheats. There was several GAO reports over the last number of years saying there are companies that are, quote, tax cheats that are still getting federal contracts, and that's not supposed to happen, and that created an uproar. Well, it turns out that that's true. The vast majority of them are one-person shops that have come and go and have liens and so forth. But the point of the GAO report was, this is not that this is some sort of massive problem that affects the vast majority of government contractors. What they said was, years ago, Congress instructed the government to create an information system to link the IRS to the contract side, so you could see who actually has a fully adjudicated tax liability. And they've never done that. And so it took a long time to work with Congress around, if the IRS says that I owe money, that's not a tax cheat. Most people have an issue at some time in their lives with the IRS. The issue is, have you been through all the appeals processes and the administrative processes, and there's been a final determination that, yes, you owe money? That's where you make a decision. That's called due process. And so there's a due process question, Mark, I think that you're talking to. The appeals process and how the rest of that's going to work, I don't think we really know yet.
Okay. We are going to take a break. We are also going to talk to Simone when we come back. So you're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We shall return. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here today with Stan Soloway of Solero Strategies and Simone Seichman of Attain. Professional services. Bloomberg estimates or shows or whatever $63 billion in professional services in FY15 through a variety of vehicles. Attain is a services company. You don't sell widgets.
For the most part, no. We are management consulting and IT services. Yeah.
Okay. So with how much of that $63 billion you get anyway?
not as much as we'd like, but we're working on it.
Well, there you go. You might want to talk to Stan about that. He may be able to help. I understand that's what Solero does. We have through category management, through the smushing of schedules, new categories for professional services lumped in. How does this impact a company like Attain in your go-to-market strategy?
Well, I think in terms of category management in particular, how it impacts us, I think still remains to be seen. There's a lot of working and positioning and planning that's still going on in the area of category management. But I think fundamentally over the longer term, it's clear that agencies will be purchasing in a different kind of way. And I think companies need to be prepared to respond. Category management is just one of the areas where there's a shift in how things are being purchased. Another large trend is the increased use of GWACs, government-wide acquisition contracts, agency-specific IDIQs, and in some cases even shifts from some IDIQs or GWACs to others. For example, the shift of DHS from buying the way they had been buying through Eagle, for example, over to now using Oasis. And there are other agencies that have put in place MOUs to use GSA contracts. So there's a big shift that I think will, over the longer term, not only change how companies are going after business, but even which ones can go after business, since there's always a limited number of companies on these GWACs.
Okay, yeah. So, but on the GWACs especially, if you don't own a prime spot, you always have the ability to partner to gain access, but you really have to bring something significant to the table. Do you play in that role, or do you have a sufficient swash of GWACs in place to play whichever game you want?
I would say we've been doing very well with GWACs in our past, and we're certainly trying to broaden the portfolio to gain greater access in the future. So I think it's a strategic planning kind of thing where a company needs to ensure that they have enough runway in front of them to keep the speed up and stay aloft.
You know, one of the things I think is going on that Simone is alluding to is this is a dynamic environment. And so the shift from one GWAC to another, or the shift across different IDIQ vehicles, is something we see periodically. I mean, this is just the nature of the beast. And it's way back, you know, in the 90s when we started seeing the rise of IDIQs, one of the things that was very clear is you wanted to avoid having mandatory contracts because there was always a better or new vehicle or a different way the government wanted to approach the market because the market's changing. And I think that's the strategic issue Simone's talking about. It's both what vehicles, but how do you actually offer on different vehicles in a market that's undergoing, and I don't mean a market from a sales, I'm talking about an offerings market, a technology market that's undergoing such major change. So if you think about things, you talk about professional services at $63 billion. I don't use that figure, and it's not a criticism of Bloomberg, only because as we move to the as-a-service model in software as a service, platforms as a service, you name it as a service, infrastructure as a service, the way things are coded in the federal procurement data system are no longer exactly the way we traditionally have thought about them. So you really have to look at sort of the full IT and professional services spend, mush it together, and realize that there's a lot of fungibility between different things that are actually the same or would otherwise have traditionally been professional services. Much like we talk about IT, so much of it's now embedded in a broader capability. The other thing that's I think, interesting, is one is the incremental buying, is that whether it be IDIQs or go to GWACs or so forth, it is no question that the government, like much of the private sector, is slowly but surely moving into the other end of the solution spectrum to buying in pieces rather than total, full, integrated, complex solutions. You look at what the Department of Education is doing with its Educate contract and others. That's fairly typical in the commercial world, and I think you're seeing more of that in the government, which requires companies to also adjust. And finally, we could talk about category management separately later. I think that the other piece, and Simone alluded to this also, maybe he was too polite not to say it, but I don't mean this in a negative way. There is a real question as to what GSA's role is going to be in this market over the next 5 years. GSA is making a very concerted effort to build its market share. When Dan Tangerlini was there, he said at a public meeting he wanted 85% market share. So they are doing a lot to attract more agencies to use their vehicles, be they schedules, the consolidated schedules, or OASIS, Alliant, et cetera. And I think that shift to GSA, or how far that shift goes, actually has some long-term implications for the market, but we actually don't know what's going to happen. But all of this is just market dynamics, and people just have to be aware of it and be as dynamic and agile as the market is.
Thoughts?
I agree with Stan. It's a matter of adapting, and I think that there are certainly companies that are positioning and probably some that are going to find themselves in difficult positions later on. Mark, you mentioned the ability to join a team for some of these IDIQs if a company isn't on them. And that's certainly always an option. It is a little bit more of a challenge for mid-sized companies to get on teams because very often when you have large primes, they're looking for small business subcontractors in order to support meeting of small business goals. And so the mid-sized companies that sometimes have difficulty gaining a spot on these contracts are also not always the most appealing companies in contrast to the small businesses to bring on as teammates.
Yeah, so, but we've seen some of the smalls attract, some of the small contract holders attract mid-size as partners.
So Simone, one of the things that I'd be interested in your view on, because I've talked to a lot of companies about this, and again, so I have different size companies as clients, and one thing that strikes me is that the mid-tier opportunities may actually be growing rather than decreasing from the perspective of the mid-tier companies tend to have a much more agile business models than a very, very large company has deeply ingrained process and sort of a stiff business model, and that the opportunity for mid-tiers to be a bridge to some new capabilities coming into the market may be greater because we are buying in smaller chunks and the government is looking for new solutions and new capabilities, and maybe the mid-tier really becomes that vital bridge. Is that something that you guys are focusing on?
I think that's absolutely true. That's one of the ways in which we like to market ourselves is as a company that is agile, able to bring in innovation, able to customize a little bit more to what's unique to a particular government requirement. And another area where I think the mid-sized companies have an advantage over some of these really large system integrators is just fundamentally on price, where these companies are typically working with higher overhead rates. We rarely lose to big system integrators on price. We can be more competitive. And so if you can put together the right solution, bring in innovation, and have it be cost effective, I think there is definitely a spot for the mid-sized companies.
And Mark, that speaks to a real misperception, I think, on the government side. And too often we're hearing so much talk about innovation only comes from one geographic location, or use the geographic location as an adjective, but various pockets. And in fact, there's huge innovation available. And to take anything to scale, a lot of the innovators, in quotes, need to be able to partner with companies that have deep domain knowledge, deep domain expertise to try to combine the two. And I think the mid-tier companies offer some of that uniquely.
I'll give a couple of other examples. Another area is just one of bureaucratic processes. We've sometimes attempted to work on sort of very quick turnaround opportunities with some of the large companies, and we found that just their approval processes to pursue an opportunity are sometimes so, it's such a big machine that they can't approve the staff to go after an opportunity if it's too short a turnaround. And that's one area where the mid-sized companies are a little more agile. Another one, I think, is in the willingness to take on risk. And this isn't universally true of all mid-sized companies, but I think you'll find some companies that are willing to take on a certain level of risk that may be unappealing or unpalatable to some of the larger system integrators. The willingness to share in development cost and then down the line share in some of the savings that come as a result. So I think the area of risk sharing is something that I think will probably be more influential in driving acquisition decisions in the future.
Which is not to say that this is not a tough market for mid-tiers. I mean, going back to the beginning where you started and Simone started, this is a tough market. You have to be really creative and really strategic. I think all we're both saying is, with some new thinking, there are actually ways to overcome this that might not have been available 3 or 4 years ago.
Right. But, you know, let's talk about that mid-tier thing for just a minute, because there's been a lot of hubbub about there should be a mid-tier level contract award mechanism because they're caught between here and there. And I think there's a misconception here. If you're a recently graduated small business, you may be too small to really be considered mid-tier.
Well, I mean, there's no more, to me, no more logic to creating a mid-tier set-aside than there is to the proposal the administration floated a couple of years ago to create a set-aside for, quote, innovative companies, small companies that had a, quote, limited government experience. I have no idea what that means, and I have no idea what mid-tier means. So to take your example, if I'm a $27 million company and I've graduated from the IT small business size standards and I'm competing with a $700 or $800 million company, that's a pretty big gap. But that $700 or $800 million company is, in fact, a mid-sized company in this market. And so anytime you try to create another set-aside category, you're just kicking the same can down the road. And I think that we run the risk of over-segmenting the market rather than letting some of the market freely interface and interact with each other and come up with really good solutions.
Yeah. Daughter.
Well, I think this question of whether there should be a mid-tier category comes up frequently. Honestly, at Attain, we don't get really hung up on it because there isn't, at the moment, any real legislative impetus to put in place that kind of change. And so until there is, the reality is that that category doesn't exist. So we'd rather spend our effort pursuing opportunities as best we can rather than complaining about the acquisition framework. And the other reality is, if you were to create a new category, people would be graduating from that category, and new graduates or from any category are always going to be slightly disadvantaged relative to the much larger incumbent players in the new larger category. So, it could certainly benefit some. There's argument from the small business community that it would disadvantage small businesses. So there would be winners, losers, but ultimately the same challenges that exist today would continue to exist in some form.
There you go. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We will return after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Stan Soloway of Celero Strategies. It is C-E-L-E-R-O hyphen strategy.
No, just Celero Strategies. It's two different
No, ways. No, I'm giving a website.
Oh, a website. Celero Strat hyphen Strat.
Okay. .com.
Yes, sir.
There you go. And Attain is attain.com.
That's right.
There you go. Simple. And that was Simone Seichman, by the way. So let's wrap up on category management. Give me your final thoughts here. I think it's fine for products. Beyond that, Stan?
Strategically, conceptually, it is exactly the right thing to do. I think, as you said, when you get beyond products or commodity or true commodity services, it becomes a really challenging exercise. And sometimes we move too quickly down a path without figuring out what all the complexities are. So my issue is not with those who think it's a good idea, because I understand the logic and the strategic thinking behind it. The concern I think and others have is on execution and if it can be done right. But it's also inextricably linked to other elements of what other components of what GSA is doing. For example, we now have calc.gov, which is supposed to be a better lens into the published schedule rates that companies have, which is fine. It just it's already public and it opens the gate a little bit more clearly and easily to contracting officers. But the next step is intended to be a prices paid portal. Well, once you get beyond commodities, whether it be a true commodity service or a commodity product, prices paid becomes a really complex issue because when you're in professional services and IT and technology, what I paid for something 2 years ago may look like the same thing I'm buying today, but it may in fact have multiple differences. There are all kinds of nuances on complexity. There's all kinds of issues that data does not capture. Plus, we're in a low price, technically acceptable world. So if I had to bid low to win a contract 2 years ago, I don't want that to become the ceiling for what happens in the future, because that might have been a bid that was lower than the work was valued at. So you can't capture these nuances in a database. And I think that to GSA's credit, and Tiffany Hickson and others who are working on this, they kind of recognize this and they're trying to figure out how to get at that question. But you could, if you take this to the next logical step, or let's say even not even extreme step, end up doing what I've called over the years management by abdication. It becomes a data-driven, check the box, here's my four qualified bidders, here's the prices they paid, here's what the category says, and it leads me to a linear decision when in fact the considerations are not entirely linear and have to have a lot more nuance and context to them.
I think ultimately the true benefit and the true negative impacts are going to come down to execution. As Stan said, the intent is a positive one that in principle people wouldn't argue with. There's still a lot of uncertainty out there. They're still putting in place category managers. It's not obvious yet what sort of mandates will drive the use of these categories. We know that there will be increasing use, but we don't know exactly how that will be directed from above. And I completely agree with Stan's comment in distinguishing between products versus services, and even in the services space, commodity type services versus more specialized or unique types of services, particularly in the area of, again, referring back to some of these government-wide acquisition contracts or IDIQ contracts, you'll often have labor categories that are broad, but ultimately when you deliver a particular type of capability or a solution, you may have quite varied sorts of individuals that are placed in those labor categories for the purposes of putting together price proposals. And so you can't necessarily assume that you're going to be able to do apples to apples comparisons when it comes to historical pricing and how that would be measured against some proposed pricing for something new.
Okay. So on the issue of past performance, which is coming down the pike rapidly, once again, Stan, you've got another article out there. I don't know how many pubs you write for. I only write for WashTech, then my blog, my newsletters, and LinkedIn. That's enough.
I repurpose articles. So the past performance issue that I raised recently is actually not simple nor not complicated, nor is it new. It's a recent Inspector General report on the Army having completely inadequate records. I think they said around $1.5 billion of contract value that they looked at. Without getting into the specifics of the report, the question is, how could we possibly still be having this conversation? It's been 20 or 25 years since we really got serious about past performance. A lot of people agree that past performance, if done right, could be, in some cases, the most important determinant of future success. And we are just not getting it right. We're not getting the records put in there. So you have a system that's not functioning as it should, which disadvantages really high-performing companies. I think Simone would probably agree that there are companies that find out when they go to pull their CPARs that they don't even exist, which means the companies are now having to put extra effort into making sure that their contracting officers are actually doing the past performance reports because they need them for future work. It should be a routine. It should not be something that's seen as overly onerous. And if we didn't have contracting officers doing so much non-value-added work and putting so much process requirement on them, they'd have a little bit more time to contribute past performance reports that can really help. The second issue is, what is past performance and how do we determine it? And I think we have to really start thinking much more broadly about what past performance we need to consider in the award of a government contract. Two examples. I believe it was OASIS. I could be wrong at GSA, but what was a major GSA vehicle that said, if you have no government past performance and you only have commercial past performance, we're going to give you a neutral rating. Well, which is basically a negative, because that means you're disadvantaged against those with strong ratings. The Defense Information Systems Agency even went one step further. Literally the same week that Secretary of Defense Carter was in Silicon Valley talking about the need to bring new capabilities into the market, and Attain looking at bringing in a new partner that has some real great capability, they can combine their expertise and deliver something. The week that he was out there talking about that, DISA came out with Encore 3 RFP and said, we're not going to consider past performance at all. That's not DOD specific. So we've got a lot of work to do on this and start recognizing that, A, this should be an absolutely routine part of the process and it needs to be meaningful. Sad that 20 plus years later, we're not getting it right. And B, we need to open the aperture on what past performance is if we really want to get creative, innovative solutions into government, whether it's through an existing contractor or a new player coming into the market.
Simone, you have some issues with contracts you're going after this way.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they've been major issues, but we have found, as we were pursuing Alliant 2 recently, that part of the submission process for projects that demonstrate experience includes the documentation and inclusion of CPARs in the proposal package. And we did find that some of our past projects didn't have CPARs available. And so that's always a challenge dealing with that kind of thing in a rushed time frame.
Okay.
And I think, again, this is I think what Simone's highlighting is how important it is, until we get this right, for companies to have routine reviews of all of their contract files just to make sure the CPARs are being entered. And second, to make sure the CPARs that are being entered are accurate. Remember, contractors have the right to comment on their own CPARs, on their own past performance reports, much like a personnel file. You can't change it, but you can comment on it. And it ought to be, again, fairly routine, but companies are going to have to spend more resources than they should have to make sure that they're getting fair evaluations and that they can use those evaluations for future work, which ultimately inures to the benefit of the taxpayer.
Okay. We're going to take our last break here. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Stan Soloway of Solero Strategy and Simone Seichman of Attain, and we shall return. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I am Mark AmTower. Nobody else volunteered. Simone Seichman is here with me from Attain, Stan Soloway from Solero Strategy, and Simone, predicated on what we've been talking about for the last 30 minutes or so, which vehicles are most attractive to a company like Attain? Where do you want to see most of your business coming from?
Well, I think it would be hard to name a specific set of vehicles just because our portfolio is evolving from day to day. We've been growing quite quickly. We've well over doubled in size in just in fact, we've almost doubled in size twice in the couple of years that I've been working at Attain.
Without acquisitions, right?
Without acquisitions. Yeah. But what I would say is we definitely are focusing on adding more of a GWAC and IDIQ set of contracts to our portfolio. We are looking at GSA contracts, obviously, things like OASIS and Alliant 2. We're also looking at agency-specific GWACs, particularly in DOD, where there's some large ones in play at the moment. But as I had mentioned earlier, I think there is a trend towards increasing spending through the use of these contracts. And so it's becoming more important for companies to adapt accordingly, just to not be left out in the cold when it comes to having access to the opportunities that are going to be there in the future.
Okay. One of the interesting things for companies of all sizes, and I suspect Attain looks at this as well, or goes through this as well, is as new vehicles or recompetes come up, the degree to which there is continued redundancy in those vehicles over other vehicles, and trying to guess what the customer is going to want and which ones they're going to use. But the other dynamic is, if you look at a couple big areas like health IT, we now have the new health IT SIN the GSA has created. Is that going to be the only or the best way for other agencies to access health IT capabilities? The cyber capability that GSA is building, or they're going to actually have a really interesting process to get on there to get that SIN is four parts that you're going to have to literally come in and do demonstrations. It's like doing orals for each of the four parts. I think you can get on one or all four. It's like protection and detection and so forth. those kinds of activities, I mean, those are big spend areas right now, will dictate where companies have to go. And the question will be, ultimately, do other agencies start trying to replicate that, or do we actually have now a consolidated focus of how the government wants to buy cyber, for instance? Now, the flip side of that is, we don't know where the cyber market's going to go long term, because, in fact, anybody who's doing any technology with the government has to be doing cyber, is bedded into that technology. So for how long do we need to have huge independent cyber products? And I don't say that cyber is not important, but more and more of it's embedded in everything we do. So those kinds of strategic decisions, I suspect, are not easy for companies at this point because they're very unpredictable.
That's true. It is. But I think, you know, whether the cyber sins are right or wrong, I think it is a reflection of GSA trying to be a little more responsive to its market within the federal agency space. If you look at Alliant 2, the addition of the leading edge technologies, which are forward looking type of technology areas, is something that really distinguished Alliant 2 from Alliant and some of the other contracts. And I think the intent there was to say, well, we should look not only at the service portfolio within the federal government today, but make sure that at the end of the contract 10 years from now, that the technologies that are cutting edge today, but maybe commodity 5 and 10 years from now, are going to be available on this contract so that agencies don't have to go elsewhere to get those types of capabilities. So I think in its attempt to gain more market share, which we talked about a little bit during the break, GSA is certainly trying a variety of strategies to ensure that it can meet its stakeholders' needs.
We're also going to see this play out in the whole agile software development arena. GSA, of course, has the BPA in place for agile software development. It's a GSA-only vehicle. There are other agencies that are looking at doing their own, and some of them aren't sure. Do they want to use GSA? GSA doesn't have the authority to sell off its BPA to other agencies at this point, and there's a push to do that. There's a real market growth there. The concern that a lot of us have is that's one vehicle with one set of providers, a lot of it built on the presumption that Agile is the purview of small startup companies. And the reality is that there are a lot of companies in the marketplace, including some large ones, that are very good at Agile software development. And if we start going in with that mindset, which goes back to my earlier points about innovation, that's going to close a market to folks who actually have incredible capabilities. And that could be an Attain, it could be a much larger company, and it could be a small company. And so how that begins to evolve and where it plays in the sort of broader pantheon of opportunities is still to be determined.
Okay. So Larry Allen's newsletter, I read it every Monday, comes in around 10:30 or 11 o'clock the week ahead. Last week he talked about the specter of sequester yet again. And, you know, I was kind of hoping this was behind us, but apparently not. Why?
It's not behind us because there's no political will to solve the problem, and it's been around for a while. And people forgot when they signed the 2-year budget deal that we still had sequestration on the horizon, and they're going to have to do some more work on it. And thus far, we've seen Congress is just really incapable of getting beyond the first steps. I mean, the Senate committees have done their bills, the appropriations bills. The House committees are not done yet. There are stark differences on whether what we always knew was going to be a continuing resolution, how long it would be, whether it's going to get us just through the election or gets us into February so we get through into the next administration. There's all kinds of obvious political calculus going on both sides as to which would be more advantageous. And I'd actually, you know, in addition to the specter of sequester, which is a great title, back in June, I actually wrote a piece saying, you know, let's not ignore the potential, as distant as it may seem, of a shutdown, because we had members of Congress who hadn't yet at that point gone through their primaries. So the presidential primaries were effectively over. But the congressional primaries were taking place all summer, and the question was going to be, what were they hearing back from their local constituencies in terms of how hardline they were going to be and so forth? And that is what we're now starting to see play out in some of the conversations on the Hill. I don't think we're going to see a shutdown, although I would not say there's no chance. I'd say there's maybe a 10% chance of that. But the fight over the budget, the reemergence of sequester earlier than people thought, the implications for different agencies, it's going to have an impact. Now, agencies are very, very, what I've always admired about them is their ability to adapt. And so most of the agencies of government have adapted really well to, is it 18 years now of CRs or whatever the number is? And they've learned
since the mid-90s.
Yeah, so they've learned how to manage against it. It's not a smart management or efficient management. That's not their fault. But they've learned how to manage against it. And so maybe they're learning a little bit how to manage and message around sequester. But this is not a small deal. And I think that it's something that we need to keep our eyes on. The last time this all happened, as you know, we saw sequester take effect months before it actually hit because agencies were getting ready for it. We haven't seen that happen yet, but we also don't have fourth quarter data. We don't actually know exactly what's going on in the market yet. We won't know until sometime in October for the civilian agents, and we won't know until next year for DOD. But this is the kind of thing that creates a level of uncertainty in the marketplace, which is what investors hate and what companies hate. They need a little bit of, and by the way, agencies hate it. They need to know where they're headed.
Yeah, Simone, you were still at Commerce when this particular thing hit the fan.
That's right. And Stan just mentioned that agencies were preparing for it. They were preparing for it as a matter of policy. OMB directed agencies to develop sequestration plans and make decisions in advance of how they would be responding. I think you're seeing a little bit less of that today because of the uncertainty around what's going to hit, how it's going to hit, what's the impact going to be, will it even happen at all? There's this big question of whether people address the problem or just kick it down the road or pass some sort of resolution to avoid dealing with it during a politically sensitive year. So I think you're seeing a little bit less direct planning, but as Stan said, agencies have figured out how to work around it. I think you used to see new initiatives starting right after a new fiscal year started, and it's been so long since we've had a budget right at the beginning of the fiscal year that you'll often now see new initiatives starting halfway through the year. After, in the cases when we don't have a full year CR and a budget is actually passed, new initiatives can start at that point. I think you also have some strategic decision making around what actually is a new initiative versus what isn't. I'm aware of one particular agency that had issued a draft RFP with a particular title. And when they issued the final RFP, the work was more or less the same, but it had a new name. And the new name sounded more like the types of services that they already had in place, so that this new opportunity would sound more like a consolidation of things they were already doing rather than a brand new initiative.
Yeah.
And the idea there is they can now fund this within a CR if they need to, without getting into politically difficult discussions about whether they're appropriately spending during the early stages
creativity
of a CR.
Abounds.
So there's a lot of adaption going on both on the agency side and then also in the marketplace with the contracting community.
And the other thing is it for companies and for agencies, it depends on which side of the aisle you are. If you're on the defense side, it's a lot bigger issue than if you're on the civilian side. In fact, some civilian agencies, sequester was always going to be the best deal they got because of the other planned budget cuts. So for them, it actually was not a negative. If you look at the president's budget direction, budget guidance to the agencies for the 2018 budget, I think they were told to plan a 5% reduction. And so for the civilian side of the House, civilian agency side of the House, sequester or non-sequester, it's not clear it makes a massive difference. For the Defense Department, you just look at the data and the statistics, it has a very, very big hit, very, very big implication. And that's, I think, where the real pressure is.
Okay. Final thoughts, Simone.
Well, I think one of the major areas that we just didn't have time to get into is how the whole administration change is going to affect the landscape. And it's going to happen at a number of levels. Obviously, the senior most leadership at GSA will be changing. The policy making that happens at OMB and within OFPP may change a little bit. It may change dramatically. It really depends on who comes in and who's responsible for making those new policies. We have a reasonably large handful of politically appointed CIOs who presumably most of which, if not all of which, will be turning over after the administration change. It's interesting, during this administration, there was a flip-flop in both directions. There were a couple of agencies that moved from career CIOs to political CIOs, and I believe one cabinet-level agency that moved from the other direction, from a political CIO to a career CIO. I don't want to debate which is better. There are arguments on both sides, but the reality is with the administration change will come changes in leadership and strategy and direction also at the CIO level. So it'll be interesting to see how all of this affects the marketplace and how the contracting community responds.
And I think also in addition to what Simone's saying, we go through this every 4 or 8 years. It's not new. What's a little bit different this time is that we don't have much insight into the sort of management agendas of the candidates. Now, a federal management agenda is not an election issue. Nobody in the broad public really pays any attention to it. But by this point in 2008, Barack Obama had given a major speech, or right around now gave a major speech. It sort of laid out some of his priorities. Hillary Clinton has given a technology and innovation talk, but she hasn't really spoken to the to the management side. So you don't actually have a vision into sort of what their intentions are, because you get a sense of the direction. The people are going to implement the direction that the candidate talks about. On the Republican side, Donald Trump is just now beginning to put together a small infrastructure for the transition. There are some folks who are actually starting working groups and so forth. I've been involved in some in the Clinton administration. Those working groups have been around for months, which is much more traditional infrastructure. Once you start getting a little bit of sense of what their direction they want to go in, you can sort of begin to plan. The one thing I will say is that since the 80s, really, each administration has had a fairly logical next step over the previous administration on their management and technology agendas. It's not been a terribly partisan issue, which is why in this particular case, some vision, some sort of white paper approach to the folks who actually focus on this stuff have a sense of it actually means something, because they typically have been building blocks on each other. It's not been as partisan as other things have been. But Simone's actually absolutely right. As we all know, we're going to have a massive turnover of thousands of senior positions in the government. It's going to take a long time to get it done. The government keeps functioning. 2008 is not a good example because we were in crisis, and so things were happening very rapidly then. We don't know exactly how the market will respond, and I mean the government spending side of the market. But I think over the next month or two, we'll have a much better sense once we see where the CR goes and at least get some insight into what the highest priorities from a management perspective that candidates have.
Okay. We got to wrap it up. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for coming in today. I've been talking to Stan Soloway of Solero Strategy and Simone Seichman of Attain. I am Mark Amtower. This is not my day job. If you need help on the marketing side of government, give me a shout. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me at federaldirect.net or email me at mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you very much for listening to Amtower Off Center.
You've been listening to Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Amtower Off-Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.